Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimper with the Public Policy Channel, and today I'm pleased to welcome David Pilling, the Africa editor for the Financial Times. David is the author of The Growth Delusion, Wealth, Poverty, and the Wealth of Nations, published in 2018 by Penguin Random House. David, welcome.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
So before we dive in and talk about the book, I wonder if you might tell our audience just a little bit about you, your background, and perhaps the questions that have led you up to this particular project.
Sure. Well, I'm a journalist for the Financial Times newspaper. I've almost exclusively been a foreign correspondent, and I've done that job for about now more than 20 years anyway. I've worked in Latin America. I spent an awful long time in Asia, first as the Tokyo bureau chief and then as Asia editor looking after the whole continent. And now I'm the Africa editor. So I've, you know, my job has taken me around the world, looking at the world through FT eyes, which are primarily sort of economic and business eyes. They're certainly not exclusively. And I've done other jobs as well, writing about business and you know, editing in London some of our content. So I've been, I suppose, what you might call a serious, I hope, financial journalist for most of my career, you know, working for one of the most serious financial newspapers in the world. But because we're invited at the Financial Times to, you know, to think critically, I've often just wondered about this this number that we take extremely seriously, GDP, gross domestic product, which of course can be shorthand simply for growth. When we talk about growth in the last quarter or growth in the last year, we are talking about growth of GDP, or indeed the economy, because when we talk about the size of the US economy or the size of the Chinese economy, we are using in one form or another gross domestic product as our basis for talking about that. And so really my career at the FT has led me in a sort of not initially particularly systematic way, but it led me to sort of query, well, what is this thing that we talk about? What is this thing that we give so much emphasis to? And to cut a long story short, I think when I arrived in Japan, this really crystallized some of my thinking. Because when I arrived in 2002, and I was in Japan for 7 years, Japan had not grown in nominal terms for 20 years. So the graph of Japanese GDP was flat. It really, if it were a heart patient, it would have been dead. And, you know, the editors in London would look at Japan through that prism, the prism of GDP, and think that Japan must be a total disaster. And sitting in Japan, I knew that Japan had many problems and issues like all countries, but I also knew that to think of it as a total disaster or as an economic basket case or as somewhere that had failed economically was to really miss the point. There were an awful lot of things that were going on in Japan that weren't remotely explained by this number that appeared to show that the Japanese economy had stalled and was going nowhere. And I mean, I can certainly go back to that issue and talk to you about that. But that's really what led me, I suppose. That was the trigger for the book, although the book I read a book on Japan first. So the book still took maybe 10 years to come. But that was probably the trigger that made me begin to write about some of this stuff for the Financial Times, and then to think more broadly about how I could bring what I saw as called slightly more rigorous delving into this subject to a broader audience. Because I think that sort of most people out there know that the measures that we use to measure our world don't somehow reflect what our lives feel like. And I wanted to examine the gap between our measurements and what the world feels like, and to look at that as a way of sort of analyzing really the world we live in and what we think it is.
So why don't we start with GDP, with gross domestic product itself? And can you talk a little bit what the heck is it? What is it purporting to measure, and maybe sort of to the extent that it's relevant, where does that come from? Why is that the thing that we use as the chief indicator of how well the economy is performing?
Sure. Well, GDP, first of all, is a flow measure. It measures the flow of income all the goods and services produced, the value of those goods and services produced over a certain period, a quarter or a year. It's a backward-looking measure because we can only know what has been produced. We can't know what will be produced next year. So it's a backward-looking measure, and it's a flow over a certain period. Now, how it came about is fascinating, and there's quite a lot. Well, there's certainly a chapter or two about this in the book. Really, before the 1930s, there was no way, not in the modern sense, of talking about the economy. In British politics, for example, the word the economy was not used in any political manifesto until 1950. No one said we're going to make the economy better in a political manifesto until 1950. It's now unthinkable that political parties wouldn't use this phrase on almost every page of their manifesto. But if you wind back to the 1930s, there wasn't the language to do that. An economy meant a saving. I'm going to be economical. I'm going to be economical with my household expenditure or economical with the truth. But there was no the economy. So Franklin FDR was elected in 1933, as your listeners will know very well. And of course, this was after the Wall Street crash, the midst of the Great Depression. Roosevelt wanted to spend a lot of money as part of what became the New Deal, which came in various phases. And so in 1933, he asked a man called Simon Kuznets to come up with a measure of the economy, because in order to spend a lot, he needed to know precisely what had happened. And it's almost unthinkable today, but they didn't really know back then. They had indicators like freight car loadings. They knew the stock market was in a bad way. They knew that unemployment had spiked. But they didn't have a single measure to say the economy was this and now it's that. So they sent out Kuznets with a team, a very small team of five or six people. Kuznets, a brilliant economist and somebody who took data very seriously. And Kuznets went around asking people what they'd spent, what they bought, and then asking producers what they'd produced and what they'd bought in order to produce what they produced. And because without going into too technical a detail, GDP is not the measure of all goods and services added up. Because if you think about it, that would be to double, treble, and quadruple count all the things we make. So if you have a loaf of bread that costs $5, that loaf of bread has not contributed $5 to the American economy, because there is flour in the bread, which you've already counted at the stage of flour. And there is wheat in the flour, which you've already counted at the stage of the farmer. And then there is electricity, because you need to heat the bread. And there's labor costs. So at each stage, you need to work out what's called the value added. And that's really by subtracting all the inputs that go into the final product. Anyway, Kuznets and his team did this remarkable job, and it really was a remarkable job, in a very short period of time. And in 1934, they produced a document, and the document, which was actually to change the world, and his invention has been called one of the great inventions of the 20th century. And even though I've written a book critical of GDP, I would not argue with that assessment. So this great invention was the title that he gave to it was National Income 1929 to 1932. Perhaps economists don't always have a great sense of kind of drama and sort of literary razzmatazz. But this was an extraordinarily important document. And within it, it contained the finding that the American economy, which you could now measure, had halved in value between 1929 and 1932, that the economy had shrunk by no less than half. And so this gave Roosevelt the ammunition to spend lots of money. But even at this stage, when you could argue that, you know, this was the zenith, the high point of GDP, because it enabled Roosevelt to come up with this very important policy, Kuznets had several warnings that I would say that we have sort of routinely ignored. One is, this is not a measure of well-being. Please do not confuse GDP with well-being. They're entirely different things, said Kuznets. And I would argue that in the public discourse, those two concepts have kind of elided, and that too often, even though economists will tell you, of course, it's not a measure of well-being, but in the public discourse, you know, we assume that growing the economy must be good and must be good for us and must in the end be good for our well-being and make us happier.
An increase in growth is always a good
thing. It's always a good thing. But Kuznets, the man who invented it, said, no, not necessarily. The second thing he said is don't look at the headline number. The headline number is very crude and tells you, you know, something, but you need to delve beneath. So, for example, I think Kuznets found that even in the Great Depression, the wealthy had come out of it in a much stronger position. It really affected poor people more. So inequality had grown. Kuznets was very interested in this finding. But the point that I'm trying to make is that Kuznets warned a headline figure is one thing, but we really need to delve beneath the numbers. Something, again, I would say that we often fail to do. The third thing that Kuznets...
Or almost always fail to do.
Almost really, always, right? Yes. Well, I'm trying to give people the benefit of the doubt. And the third thing that Kuznets said, and this was in a sense a continuation of his idea that this is not a measure of well-being, he wanted to take off various things, to subtract various things from the GDP measure, because he said it shouldn't measure everything. It should only measure things that that we value. So Kuznets, for example, wanted to take out military armaments, bombs and guns and naval ships, spending on the military, because he thought that this didn't contribute to human welfare. It might be necessary as a defensive expenditure, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't adding to the sum total of human welfare. Now, we can dispute that. Some people may argue with that, and this was Kuznets talking at a particular time. But nonetheless, Kuznets would have liked to have subtracted armaments. Kuznets wanted to subtract financial speculation. Very interesting in light of the 2008 financial crash, because he thought that financial speculation was basically a kind of useless activity that could be very dangerous and certainly should not be counted as part of our economy, which is again something that we have absolutely ignored. So just before the financial crash, the banking sector, which was about to sort of bring, in my opinion, kind of mayhem and disaster, was actually contributing about 10% to US, of US GDP, the way that we measured it. Kuznets would have valued it more or less at zero. Kuznets wanted to take away some other things as well, kind of controversial, but interesting to think about. He wanted to take away the roads and the railways that take people to their offices, because he saw that as an input into production. What we wanted to measure was the output, what people actually made, and the services they produced. And he saw the commute to work as an input, rather like the flour in bread or the wheat in flour. He also wanted to take away advertising. This is very controversial, because he thought that advertising kind of awoke in people, you know, a desire for useless things that didn't really contribute much of anything and just made us produce more and more and more for no benefit. Now, you can see that Kuznets had a particular sort of, you know, ideological framework that some of your listeners might respond to and some might not agree with. But the point is that what we count as the economy, what we say is GDP, is not a fixed thing. It's not something that's really there that is to be measured. It's something that we have invented. Kuznets, for example, wanted to take out government expenditure. Very interesting, given that you know, governments often drive our economies. Now, he lost all of these battles. He lost them in the context of the Great Recession, because obviously you couldn't take out the government, because Roosevelt precisely wanted to spend money to get the economy going again. And you certainly couldn't take out armaments, because where were we? We were in the run-up to the Second World War, and GDP became extraordinarily useful, actually, in the Second World War. And some people say it was as important as the invention of the atomic bomb in deciding how much of the economy could be diverted towards armaments, when America could enter Europe and Asia militarily. And GDP became very important in this. So Kuznets lost these battles really before he began. And the story actually goes on, but I'll stop there for a moment. But that is really how this measure, which came out of a particular period, began to become consolidated. And the story does go on after the Second World War and right up to the present date.
But there continues to be sort of related problems with the kinds of things that Kuznets identified, is that as you point out in any number of different kinds of ways, the GDP does not distinguish between good growth and bad growth. right? So if there's a horrible oil spill off the coast and that creates enormous employment and the production of machinery and technological innovation to remove the oil, that is arguably no net positive when all is said and done. We've still probably done enormous damage to the ocean, to potential future fishing. Can you talk a little bit about both sort of the ways in which GDP fails to, in the current moment, distinguish between sort of good and bad spending? And then if you would talk a little bit about there about also the ways in which it fails to think about longer term health and well-being and national wealth or even global wealth.
Sure. Well, I think that you've explained the good and bad production extremely well. You know, an economy where there is more crime, that adds to GDP because, you know, you need more defensive expenditure, you know, burglar alarms, guns.
Doctors in hospitals.
You know, police forces, doctors in hospitals, what have you. The more you spend on healthcare, and America, of course, spends about 17% of GDP on healthcare, that contributes to GDP. But another way of putting that is healthcare is very expensive in the United States. It's the United States spends about twice the proportion of GDP on healthcare.
With worse outcomes European countries. Than other rich democracies.
With generally worse outcomes, unless you're very wealthy, in which case healthcare is fantastic. But for the median American, you know, the outcome is no better, and in some cases actually not as good as countries that spend a lot less. So one way of saying, you know, American healthcare contributes a huge amount to American GDP is American healthcare is extraordinarily expensive and bad value for money. So that's the kind of good and bad production that we just don't, and pollution, which is a kind of, as you mentioned, the oil spill, but that could be, you know, any number of things, plastic cups that don't biodegrade for hundreds of years, you know, the invisible, what economists call externalities that are involved in production, whether that's, you know, pollution of the air or the rivers or what have you. But there's another broader point, which I alluded to just at the beginning, which was when I said that GDP is a flow measure. So I'd just like to take this for a second to the kind of personal. And I sometimes tell this story about, and there is a little story in the book, I think, about Bill the banker and Ben the gardener. So Bill the banker earns $500,000 a year. And Ben the gardener earns $25,000 a year. Who is richer? Well, clearly, Bill looks richer, you know, 20 times richer. But I have told you, all I've done is told you really the GDP of Bill and Ben. I've told you nothing about their underlying wealth. I've told you nothing about their assets. So I may have forgot to mention that Ben the gardener actually lives on a $100 million estate, which he inherited from his great aunt last year. He's 20 years old. He's going to sell the estate, move into a small apartment in Manhattan, and live off the remaining $95 million, which he's going to invest. Bill, the banker, you know, is 53. He's about to be fired. He's got, you know, a terrible cocaine habit. His bank account is in ruin. His asset position is awful, and it's about to get worse. GDP told you nothing about that. Now, think about an individual, for example, wanting a bank loan. You know, a bank wouldn't dream of just asking what somebody's income was. They would want to know what their assets were, what their collateral was. If we're looking at a company, we would never just say, what's its profits this year? Because maybe it's ran down completely its workforce, sold the factory. You know, it could have done all sorts on the asset side. And if you only looked at the profit and loss side, you'd think the company was doing fantastically well. So again, you absolutely have to have a balance sheet. Now, with a nation, exactly the same should apply, but doesn't, because we have really no measure of the balance sheet of a nation. So if you take an oil producer like Saudi Arabia or Nigeria or Angola, these countries could, and often are, merely running down their oil, appearing to be growing very fast. But unless they invest that in other forms of wealth, which might be human capital, you know, better universities, a more skilled workforce. It might be produced capital, economists call it, which might be, you know, better roads, technology, fantastic ports, airports. In other words, the infrastructure that will enable you to produce wealth in the next year and the next year and the next year and the next year going forward. And unless you have a measure of wealth, and the other thing, of course, is natural capital. So, you know, you could be completely running down your oil reserves, as I said, but you could also be destroying your rainforest. You could be plundering your oceans. You could be heating the world up to an extent where the climate actually changed and you'd reap possible impacts of that in the future. Now, this might all sound familiar. This might sound like planet Earth. And my point is that whatever we're doing to the environment, we don't really measure it in a methodical way. It's not incorporated into our national or indeed our global accounts, because the number that we look at is how fast we're growing. We're growing at 3%, that's good. We're growing at 2%, that's bad. We're shrinking, that's awful. But what is happening to these other measures that will determine how fast we can grow and what quality of life we have in the years and decades ahead? And we just do not measure that in the same systematic way. And that's one of the kind of, I suppose, pleas of my book, that we look at that more seriously.
This is the New Books Network Public Policy Channel. Excuse me, I'm Stephen Pimpare. And we've been speaking with David Pilling about the growth delusion, wealth, poverty, and the well-being of nations. So David, there's another category of things that often get folded into GDP, and you've made reference to some of these, I think. GDP doesn't account for things that don't enter into the market. So household labor, the work that is done within the home, child rearing, that doesn't factor in. Volunteerism, that doesn't factor in. Nor do things that don't happen through the formal economy, right? Through the black market or the gray economy. You know, talk a little bit about what that is, maybe the scale of that and the extent to which that distorts our sense of what kind of economic activity is at work?
Sure. Well, GDP, as I think we mentioned, you know, is pretty much a kind of a guesstimate, but it's a guesstimate almost exclusively about the part of the economy for which money changes hands. There is actually a big exception to that, because we do count people who live in their own houses. So we impute the value of the rent that people who live in their own houses would pay if they didn't live in their own house, because otherwise you'd have very kind of uneven comparisons of countries where home ownership was a big factor and where home ownership was not so common. So that is to say that there are methods of measuring bits of the economy for where money doesn't change hands, but we choose not to do it. We don't do it in advanced economies. We don't do it most kind of noticeably in things like, as you said, home production, as it's called, which could be anything from making your bed, cooking your own meals, to looking after your own children or looking after your relatives. We don't count, as you also mentioned, volunteer work. You may say that's fine, and to some extent it is fine. We can't tax that, and so the government doesn't have as much need to know what's going on inside the house as outside the house. But it does throw up a number of anomalies. So if you think about it, for example, in Japan, there is a policy called Womenomics that was put in train by the current Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. And he was very keen to get women out of the home and into the workforce in order to boost the economy. And there were some good reasons for doing this, partly because, you know, the labor force had been very male dominated. And there are very good reasons for, you know, opening up the labor market. And of course, the labor market should be equitable. You should have equal access to the labor market, whether you're a man or a woman, quite sort of self-evidently. But nonetheless, there are some interesting anomalies that throws up. So if you imagine a Japanese household in which the women are primarily taking care of children and looking after older relatives, which traditionally has been what a lot of women have done in Japan, then you move them out of their home. And let's just, for the sort of purposes of a thought experiment, let's move everybody next door. So instead of being in their own home, they move next door and they look after the children of the next door neighbors and the aging relatives of the next door neighbors. But they're paid a wage. Now, nothing has changed at all in terms of the work done, except Grandpa has no idea who this person is looking after him. But from an economic point of view, an awful lot has changed because your economy has expanded, your tax base has expanded, so the government gets more revenue that it can spend on things. But the amount of work has not changed. And I think that this throws up some sort of interesting questions, and they're almost kind of invisible. So, for example, breast milk is valued at zero in our economic modeling, whereas milk formula does make a contribution. Now, in certain settings, especially in the developing world, you know, formula milk can be very harmful, especially if it's mixed with bad water. There are very good reasons to encourage women to breastfeed, and yet the kind of economic incentives push in the opposite direction. So that's one sort of anomaly. There's another kind of interesting thing that's going on in the developed world, and then I'll move on to the developing world. In the developed world, I mean, all over the world, obviously, we're moving from analog to digital. The internet is becoming more and more a factor of our lives and a factor of the economy. But if you think of it in this way, imagine that in the past, you were booking a flight and a hotel and a holiday. You would go through a travel agent. You would call up a taxi service, and they would have somebody working in an office who would call the different cars. One would come to meet you, take you to the airport. Somebody would check you in, hand you your ticket, tag up your bag. Now, many of those things have now been outsourced, but they've been outsourced to you, the customer. So you may open up a website, book your own ticket, pick your own seat, print out your own boarding pass, order your own Uber, and even as I did fairly recently at the airport, tag your own bag and lug it across the airport and put it on a belt. Now, all of that has moved from what we used to call the economy into something that is no longer called the economy, that is like household production. It's like making your bed or looking after your kids, which I think is kind of interesting. I mean, we have this productivity anomaly supposedly at the moment where, you know, our productivity is just not going up, even though, our world seems to be changing and innovating very quickly. And this may partly explain that, because things that used to be in the economy are just kind of fading out of the economy. So I think that's something kind of interesting to think about. And there's quite a lot more I could say about that, but let's just park that for a moment. Now let's move to the developing world. So here, in India, for example, something like 80% of the economy is actually outside the market economy. It's in what sometimes called the gray economy. It may well not be taxed. Some of it may just be under the table. Some of it may be barter. Some of it may be subsistence farming. Very small scale, really below the kind of radar. And this can have a big impact, because if you begin to measure this part of the economy, you can have a sudden sort of leap. So even in an advanced economy like Italy, and they began to measure in the early 80s, I think they began to measure the grey economy more systematically. And suddenly they found that their economy was bigger than Britain's. And this was celebrated in Italy as a great event. You know, it's called Il Sorpasso. But one of the reasons was they were measuring the illicit economy. You know, I think the British probably joked that, you know, they were now accounting for the mafia. And so suddenly the Italian economy was bigger than Britain's. Again, the reason for mentioning this, I think, is that, I mean, obviously developing parts of the world are now becoming a bigger and bigger part of the global economy. They're more and more important. But large chunks of those economies are really kind of beyond the scope of traditional measures. Traditional national accounting measures to pick up on. And one very good example of that is studies that have been done using satellite imagery, and the satellites pick up nightlights. So if you can imagine the Korean Peninsula, for example, so you have the South Korean Peninsula, which at night is ablaze with lights, and that's really a proxy for all the economic activity going on. If you move north to the North Korean bit of the peninsula. It's virtually dark. There's a, like a little dot in Pyongyang. Now, people have done similar exercises in India and one that I'm quite familiar with in Kenya. And the results of those are really quite different from the official GDP statistics, because they pick up activity that is really kind of invisible to the official statisticians who are going around using traditional ways of measuring the economy based on kind of household surveys and, you know, asking people questions and extrapolation. Whereas these lights actually pick up a genuine proxy of economic activity, which is lights at night. And the results are really very different. So, for example, in official GDP statistics, Nairobi, the capital, figures very prominently. It can be something like 60% of Kenya's economy. Whereas in the nightlight methodology, that drops substantially to something like, I think it's 15%. And whole areas of the economy that were practically invisible to the official statistics suddenly come into, literally, into the light. So again, the purpose of making this point, I think, is that this number that we take extraordinarily seriously can be quite hazy. And of course, we for a country like Kenya, its GDP may be used to determine how much it can borrow or what interest rate it can borrow, whether it's a poor country and therefore whether it is eligible for certain parts of the aid budget and so forth. And yet the numbers that we're dealing with are extraordinarily kind of hazy. And so I think that's something that's certainly worth pointing out.
So we've got this very hazy measure, which I think may be even a polite way of characterizing its failures, that nonetheless is imputed with enormous weight and power in all kinds of different ways. So as we work our way toward concluding, can you talk a little bit, David, about what some other alternatives might be? How else, if we're trying to gauge? Well, I guess maybe that's the first question, isn't it? What is it that we're trying to gauge? Is it the overall size of the economy? Is it health and well-being? What should we be measuring? And how might we do that in a way that is a little bit more accurate or authentic?
Okay. So there are some people who advocate, you know, that sort of basically say GDP's had its day. It's just no longer fit for purpose. I actually don't argue that in my book. Maybe I'm not bold enough, but I think that GDP still tells us something important, and it's not a bad proxy for some things, especially as economies are beginning to develop. So for poorer economies moving to middle-income status, GDP can be a reasonable proxy for what's going on, and certainly a reasonable proxy for the money a government can raise to invest in those things you mentioned: health, education, infrastructure, the kind of the building blocks of development. So I'm not for scrapping GDP, although I could perhaps see a day when GDP kind of faded into oblivion, but I don't think we're at that day yet. I am for a couple of things in relation to GDP, first of all. One is, and so kind of, you know, when we hear on the radio that GDP went up 2.3% last quarter, I think people should say, well, fine, but we know, we have a kind of a good idea what is in that, what that's telling us and what it's not telling us. And without, you know, being too sort of self-publicizing, you know, if you've read my book, you would, you know, at least be equipped to do that. The second is, as a result of that, really, just to take it a little bit less seriously in the kind of constellation of numbers. So I would like to take GDP down a peg or two. That, of course, then begs the question, so if you were going to take it down a peg or two, what would you have, not in its place, but what other numbers might you have to go alongside it? Now, this can go in two directions. One direction is the kind of index direction, and that is to come up with a sort of a GDP that you agree with, let's say, a GDP that that people are comfortable with, that takes out, you know, pollution, that takes account of what is happening to the natural environment, both renewable and non-renewable resources, that perhaps has some quality of life measurements. And there are some very interesting experiments. There are even, you know, in America, Maryland has something called the Genuine Progress Index. The Canadians have kind of an alternative GDP. Now, I see these as interesting in kind of setting a political discussion going, because what you put in these numbers really reflects that that's a very political decision. And people will say to me, well, isn't that political? And I say, absolutely it is, because you only choose to measure things that you either want more of or that you want less of, because otherwise there's not much point in measuring them. And of course, we can all disagree about what those things are. I may say I want equality. You may say, well, that's not so important to me. I may say, you know, I want to preserve nature. You may say, yes, but, you know, I think growth is more important. I may say, you know, kids are watching, are playing too many video games, so I want to account for that. You may say that's nonsense. You know, kids should be able to play as many video games as they like, and we shouldn't, certainly shouldn't be measuring that. And then how you weight those various things becomes a bit of a nightmare. So I'm a sort of, I'm quite skeptical about indexes and indices. I think they're useful in terms of a political discussion. And I have no objection to people running them in parallel to GDP numbers and to discussing and arguing about what they reveal. I think that's fine. But I think that one also ought to be aware that they come with their own set of difficulties and complexities. So I'm more in favor of simple numbers. And some of these simple numbers we already have, some we don't. One measure that I would like to see us have that we don't have, not really in a systematic way anyway, is a balance sheet. So I may have mentioned this earlier, but for a company, you have a profit and loss account, which is the kind of flow of income, but you also have a balance sheet, you know, the state of its machinery, its workforce. You have a kind of a reckoning of the balance sheet, which will be responsible in the years ahead for producing the flow of profit and loss that comes out of that company. And nobody would ever invest in a company without looking both at a balance sheet and a profit and loss account. For national accounting, we really don't have a balance sheet. We don't have something that tells us the wealth of nations. All we have is something that tells us what profit did our nation make last year, to use the analogy. Again, with an individual, if an individual was going to borrow money to buy a house, the bank would not only ask what your income is, but they'd ask how old you are, how long you're likely to be able to hold that job for, what your qualifications are, what collateral you have, because they'd want to know the sustainability of your income in the years ahead. And I think that we need something similar for nations. And the World Bank, interestingly, has come out with some very interesting methodology. In the past few months, they've been working on it for years and years, but they came out with a kind of a balance sheet of nations, of 141 nations over 20 years. And I think that something like that, that began to take a bigger prominence in national accounting, would be very useful. So that's one alternative number. Some other numbers I think we already have. So I would measure I would try to capture income inequality. That's because I think it's important. As I say, some people might not, but a lot of studies, both psychological and economic, show that people don't feel content or otherwise largely as a result of the level of their income, but actually the level of their income relative to others. So once your basic needs are met, sort of your sense of well-being is largely determined by how you're doing in comparison to other people. So in very unequal societies, your sense of well-being goes down quite fast. And I would argue that some of the rage that we're seeing, you know, in Europe and in America, and some of the kind of backlash against kind of liberal democracy is fueled by a sense of sort of injustice that some people are doing much better than others. So, you know, it may be fashionable, it may be unfashionable, but I think that's some measure of equality. It doesn't mean absolute equality, but we should track equality. One way of doing that, quite simple, would just be to measure median household income. And that would tell you something, I think, quite profound, really. So rather than only saying I'm going to increase the size of the economy by X, which is really sort of saying if the economy goes up, then there'll be a trickle-down effect. but I don't particularly believe that. And I think lots of other people don't particularly believe that. So you would actually explicitly say what I'm going to target is median household income, which is a sort of a proxy for the typical household. And that would have told you in America that the typical household for decades has really been falling behind or at best kind of stagnant. So policies that targeted that explicitly might have been different from ones that that merely put growth for its own sake on the sort of hierarchy of numbers. And again, a sort of a message of my book is growth is fine, but what do we do with that growth? Growth is the means, it's not the end. So the end is societies in which we all feel better off in some way. So let's target those things. I mean, you could target some form of longevity or better still, healthy longevity. So in Japan, for example, healthy life expectancy is 4 or 5 years higher than in America and Britain. Now, that does not necessarily picked up in, well, it's not picked up in GDP at all, really. Japan's obviously a fairly wealthy country, but that doesn't show itself up in GDP. In America, which has been growing for the last 9 years and it, in some senses is recovering pretty well from the financial crisis, life expectancy actually fell in the last 2 years. Now, I think there's now been quite a lot of literature on that, and it's not exactly a secret. But it initially took some sleuthing by two economists, Anne Case and Angus Deaton, who won the Nobel Prize for economics. And they had to kind of pick through all the numbers and kind of discover this fact buried deep within the numbers. Now, you could say, well, why did they have to do that work? Surely how long we're living and how healthy we are throughout our life ought to be something that we kind of measure routinely and put kind of political backing behind. So I would argue that that is a decent number to follow. And there are many others, and there are numbers that we already have some of these. So it's not a case of coming up with whiz-bang alternatives to GDP. It's really saying growth might tell us something, but it doesn't tell us everything. And we should prioritize some other numbers that are a sort of a better reflection of our well-being alongside GDP.
Yeah. An indication that perhaps when people hear reports saying, you know, the economy did something, to perhaps pause and think for a moment and ask what that means and ask what other indicators they might want to also look at if they're trying to make some determination about their own well-being or their community's well-being or the national well-being.
I think that's exactly right. That sounds like common sense, but I think we kind of can be bamboozled into thinking the economy is everything and everything must be sacrificed to make it bigger, whereas it ought to be the other way around. The economy is there to serve us, the people. And if we turn it that way around, then I think we will not only measure things better, but we have a better chance of creating better societies.
Hear, hear. We've been speaking with David Pilling, who is the author of The Growth Delusion, Wealth, Poverty, and the Wealth of Nations, published in 2018 by Penguin Random House. Anything particularly of interest that you're working on now, David, as we get ready to say goodbye?
Oh, I haven't really thought about a new book yet, to be honest. I'm now the Africa correspondent of the FT. It's just possible I'll write something from Africa. But I'm also very interested in technology, actually, partly because I'm utterly ignorant about it in any kind of systematic way. So looking into technology and how that's really sort of, you know, causing upheaval in all our lives is another thing that I might one day have a look at.
Terrific. Well, we will follow your reporting in the Financial Times. I can't thank you enough for being generous with your time today and talking with us about the growth delusion. Be well.
Thank you so much.